Well, I've got 11 o'clock, so I'm going to go ahead and open this fundraising call. But hello, everybody. My name is Laura Barrett. I'm the Executive Director of the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, CACJ. I want to thank everyone for participating in today's group training call. I know that we have some prospective CACJ group members with us, so I just want to take a couple of minutes to let everyone know that this is a CACJ group membership training call. For those of you who are not group members, please enjoy the complimentary call. We hope that your group will soon join CACJ as a group member. It's easy to do on our website. It's $100 a year for a group to join CACJ and $35 for individuals. for all of CHEJ's group members, you're able to participate in great training calls like these and receive first priority attention from our experienced science and organizing team leaders. Now, just a couple of bits of housekeeping. Please make sure you've got the background materials that we sent earlier this morning in front of you during the presentation. Our panel will speak for about 30 minutes. All of the other participants will be on mute during this portion, and then we'll have a question and answer period for all three presenters. To keep down background noise during the question and answer period, please mute your phones by hitting star 6, and when you want to ask a question, you can unmute by hitting star 6 again. So that's the question on muting. We're going to send out an online survey after the call with a few additional materials. Please fill out the online survey. It really helps us to tailor these calls to your needs. We are recording the call, and you will be able to access it from our website within a few days. So let's dive into it. We have a great panel that I would like to introduce to you. Marjorie, known by those of us who know and love her as Margie Fine, is a fundraising and philanthropic consultant who helps nonprofits and their funders, particularly those who use community organizing as a way to affect social change. She wants to help groups move from surviving to thriving. She believes that showing groups how to raise money is very important to achieving their goals as their programs of leadership development, policy, and advocacy campaigns. Some of her clients include the Four Freedoms Fund, Midwest Academy, and the Center for Environment, Health, and Justice. Jessica Wernley is a community organizer who works in the Greater St. Louis region. She serves as the executive director of the faith-based social justice organization, United Congregations of the Metro East, for 4 years. There, she mobilized communities around such issues as workforce inclusion, decriminalization, education equity, and education equity on the local, state, and national level. She holds a master's in social work degree from the University of Illinois. Gordon Mayer is a writer and storyteller who's been ensuring that all stakeholders have a voice and helping to shape the policies that affect them for more than 20 years. For the past decade, he's been leading nonprofit organizations that support community and faith-based national advocacy and leadership development. He helps nonprofits share their news and illustrate their impact with to strengthen their advocacy and fundraising. Some of his clients include Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, Progressive Technology Project, and the U.S. Students Association. He lives in Chicago. So, Margie, you are going to first up, and then we'll have Jessica, and then we'll have Gordon, and then we'll have our questions and answers. So, Margie, please take it away.
All right, great. Can you all hear me? Laura, can you hear me?
Sure can. Yes,
all right, great. All right, lovely people, I'm really glad to be with you. So fasten your seatbelts because I have a quick 15 minutes to get through a lot of material. And how I wish I could see your faces and do your questions as we go along, but I look forward to it at the end. So write down notes and we will talk later on. So I want to go over with you how to do a donor campaign, getting over the fear of asking for money and what goes into an ask for money. The thing I wanted to start with, people might say, well, why are we asking individuals for money? We could just go to foundations. And people don't know often how much money is given away in the United States. And when they guess things like millions of dollars. But just like Jesse James was asked, who was a bank robber, why do you rob banks? He said, that's where the money is. Exactly why you should raise money from individuals. Don't rob them, but that's where the money is. In the United States, last year in 2015, $264.58 billion, with a B, was given away by individuals. People say, oh, that was just given away by Bill Gates. No, no, that was people like you and me around the country gave away $264.58 billion. Dead people, considered a charitable bequest, gave away $31.76 billion. Altogether, live and dead people gave away very close to $300 billion. You deserve some of that money. You have to go and ask people for it. That's what this call will be about. So the way that I wanted to do this is to start with a donor campaign, what it looks like, and I want you to take out that handout, and we're going to walk through it together. There's an old adage called work your plan and plan your work. That's what this should be about. Sometimes fundraising can be scary to people, but if you have a plan, it's much less scary because it gets broken down into bite-sized amounts. That's what I want this to do. So if you look at this handout, you'll see that the things that I want you to look at is having a timeline. 2 to 3 months is good. You can also do a real quickie in about 3 weeks if you needed to do it. So there's nothing magic about the 2 to 3 months. It's more giving you an idea of the steps of what go into this. It's really important to have a timeline so you know when you're going to begin and when you're going to end. Even though every day is a good day to ask somebody for money, every day is a good day to be getting a prospect or meeting somebody who could be asked for money at some point, every day. This is now when you're going to do it in a concentrated way to do it, particularly as you get ready for the fall, because in October, November, December, and particularly December, more money is given away than any other time of the year. So it's important to get ready now. On this donor campaign, you want to have a goal so you can measure against the goal how you did. We know in organizing how important evaluation is, so it really matters to have this. You want to have a hook. Is this about the fall? Is this about your anniversary? Is this a birthday? Is it some campaign that you're doing? Is it we want to double our donors? Something that you're going to organize the campaign around and ask for money for around that. You want to have a donor pyramid. Don't get scared. That's not a pyramid scheme. It's all kosher and halal. It's all regular. Or something called a gift range chart. It's the same thing. Gives you an idea of how much money you think is out there and the people you're going to ask. Can they give $25? Could they give $2,500? What's your best guesstimate about how you know the people? And getting a sense of how many you know in each category, adding that up by the sure bet people, the I'm not sure but maybe people, and then having an idea, okay, this is what our best guesstimate is that we could raise based on who we're going to be asking for money. Now, later on, Gordon's going to go over what that list looks like. But we're talking about asking people in the organization already, and we're talking about asking your Uncle Joe. Everybody who might be interested, that's who we want to talk to. You need some time to get people, to identify people who are going to do the asks, whether on the phone or in person, letters and talking points or emails that you're going to send out to people, time to do the calls and meetings. You'll see that I talk about what a possible 8-week looks like. The first part of that is just making sure your data is strong, that you've got correct emails, correct phone numbers, correct way of reaching people. You want to start, decide together in your committee on what your goal is. You want to develop this pyramid or the giving program where you know who's going to give what. You want to draft the letter or the email, and you want to make sure all your data is correct. You want to finalize the letter. And let me talk for a minute about the letter. Your fundraising letter or email should be lots of white space. You don't have to tell everybody everything under the sun. Even though you're writing it from top to bottom, people often skim it and they move around. They read the subject line. They read the PS. They read whether you wrote Dear Jessica or whether you wrote Dear Supporter. Dear Jessica wins every time for doing that. And you don't need to tell them everything under the sun. You want to think, who is it that I'm talking to? And what is my best way to speak in a language and speak about issues that person cares about? You want to be donor-centric. Who is this donor? How can I talk to them in the best possible way? You want to divide up the names. You want to give people to call that the person you're calling or meeting with has the hardest time saying no to, right? You want to, and then in weeks 3 to 6, you want to keep making the phone calls, having meetings. You can't have meetings with everybody, but I would have meetings with people who have the best chance to give you the higher dollar amount, to give you money most consistently over the longest period of time, and that you know, that you might see and know on a regular basis. You want to, in week 7, you want to hold your meetings, make sure that you've got the coordinators and team captains who are making sure that everybody's out there talking to people and calling people. And then week 8, you want to hold evaluation, thank everybody who was engaged in this work, and celebrate doing this. Okay. So again, nothing magic about those particular 8 weeks or 3 months. It's more imagining a plan and getting all of those pieces in place. Okay. Second one I wanted to talk about is that actually making the ask. Most of you are going to ask for people who've given before, and you're going to try to move up to giving at a higher level, asking them to give at a bigger level. People who have not given before but are close to you or someone in the organization, they may be giving in the first blush out of love and respect for you, hopefully we're going to steward them so they stay on to keep giving because they really like all the work that CHCJ is doing. And there are people who are interested in the cause, but they don't know anyone in the organization. Maybe you got their names because they answered a, they did something online, and so you're trying to ask them for money as well. Some people care deeply about this work. All of you on this call, I think, care deeply about this work, but don't always know how to talk about the work in a way that feels good, and actually are sometimes afraid to ask people for money. We get a lot of bad messages about talking about money in our society. In fact, people often misquote St. Paul when he talked to the Philippians and quote him as saying, money is the root of all evil. But what he said was, love of money is the root of all evil. So I want you to be in right relationship with money. Not fear it and not be, I'll do anything for this money. Right in the middle. But I want you to see money as something that gives us power. That is the ability to do things. And that's how you should do this in approaching asking people for money. When research shows that when people are asked, why did you give now and you never gave before? Number one reason, nobody asked them. So for you to be successful, you have to ask for the donation. That's the number one most important thing is that you ask and that that person is clear about what you're asking for and what you want. Most people are not going to, some people might say no to you. That's okay. You have to ask enough people. Some people will say no. I'm really good at this. Some people say no to me. But you keep asking and more people will say yes because you're not doing cold calls. You know who you're going to be asking. Most people are honored to be asked. They're not going to say, I'm never going to be your friend again. If you feel like this is begging, think of it better. Change that narrative to inviting people in to work on this really important work with me and what we're doing. So you're inviting them in to do this work. You're successful when you've asked. People you're asking are grown-ups. They can say yes or no. But your job is to make sure that you've done the ask in a really good way. Okay? All right. So we could talk more. If you have more questions about getting over your fear of asking, let's address that during our Q&A. So let's talk about actually making the ask for money. The two ways you're mostly going to be doing this is going to be on the phone or in person. And so people aren't just surprised when you call them and asking them for a donation. I like to send a letter or an email to people describing what's going on and what your request is. For some people, you're requesting to have a meeting. For some people, you're making a request to have a conversation on the call. You want to think how the person you're asking for a meeting or a call with, how do they communicate the best? If this is somebody who doesn't really talk on the phone, but they're a texter, then text them and ask them if you can get together to talk on the phone. Text them with this. If you don't get the person on the call, leave a message. It's weird when people have hang-ups. If you get somebody on the call and they say it's not a good time, get off the call, but find out first when would be a good time to talk to them. If you get them on the phone and you say, did you get the letter or email I sent you, and they don't have it in front of them, be prepared to summarize what's in that, okay? So when you're on the phone, you want to be able to chit-chat with them briefly, state why you're calling, and make the ask. And then you want to be able to thank them right away for this on the phone and make sure you follow up. When will they send in the donation? Make it very clear. All right, I'm going to talk, and we'll talk more about this in our discussion. Okay, I want to talk about the face-to-face meeting. The number one way in the United States of getting a significant donation is by having a face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball conversation with somebody. You may think this is very scary, but by the time somebody's willing to sit down with you and talk about making a donation, they're most of the way there to giving you a donation. Most people, vast majority of people, do not say, aha, let's have coffee, and then I'm going to slam you. I'm not going to give you anything. They don't do that. By the time people meet with you, they are ready to do this. If you invite them to have a meeting, they already know from the letter and the phone call that you talked about that this is going to be a conversation about money. They're going to be in this conversation trying to go from I'm considering giving to I'm delighted to give. And you can see this in the handout that I gave you about 10 points about the face-to-face meeting. You can talk about your family, talk about CGTJ, talk about everything under the sun. The goal of this meeting with somebody is to get ask for the donation and be able to address the person's question so they can get to yes on doing this. It matters how you are. It matters that you're poised, enthusiastic, and confident. Smile. Be well prepared. If you need to bring some notes with you about the organization, bring them. But don't have your head down all the time reading your notes as though the person's making a relationship with the top of your head. You want to be talking in a way that person is getting to know you and building that relationship with you. you do want to have a conversation. For those of you who've done one-on-ones or drawn out people in the community, it's similar to that. You want to have the donor do most of the talking, though you talk also. You are credentialing the organization by being the person who's making the ask. So have some questions you want to ask. Have some general things. How do they come to care about the issues in the neighborhood? What woke them up? What are their hopes and desires for in the community? Like that. If you're not sure during the meeting how to move from just having a general conversation to making the ask for money, one of my favorite things to say is, I want to respect your time. Let me respect your time. We've been sitting together for about 25 minutes. I know you're going to have to go soon, so let's turn to this, what I wrote to you about. Turn to that, and then in a very clear voice, think of a gymnastic when they stick at the end, when they don't stumble. Same way, I want you to ask. As you know, in the letter I described asking and thanking you for the $500 that you gave last year, this year I'm asking you to give $750 so we can go to 7 new neighborhoods, including yours. We're so excited about this. You made this possible. You allowed us to be so successful last year. Can I count on you for this donation? When you ask, you must be very quiet afterwards. Don't say anything. Don't say anything. Even if they bite the inside of your cheeks, just be quiet because the person is turning it over in their head, so you want to be able to give them that chance to think it through. At the end of that time, the person might say to you, wow, that's a lot of money. You might think, uh-oh, they just said no. But they didn't. They're just chewing it over. So you could say, yes, it is a significant amount of money. You were top of my list of somebody that I could go and ask for a donation like this. So say that back. If they ask you a question you can't answer, so I don't know the answer to that, but I'll get back to you. And then you must get back to them in a timely way. If they say, it sounds great, but I need to talk to my partner, great. Find out if you can talk to the partner as well, or if they might need some time, and you're going to get back to them and make sure they've got all the information that they need when they go to talk to their partner. Again, I can answer questions about this, or all of us on the call can when we get to that later part. If they say yes, many people come to the call or come to the meeting ready to say yes, say great, make them feel great about it, thank them deeply and authentically, and try to find out when they think they'll make the donation and how, so you can track it, so you can thank them again once the donation is made. Really important thing to do. So we want not just this first gift from somebody, but we want to steward them so they're going to keep giving these donations over time, which means we want to talk to them or write to them or communicate with them somehow 4 to 6 times a year, so they don't just hear from us when it's money time. So I'm going to wrap up these comments now and hope that we'll return during the Q&A to talk about more about any fears you have, what it's like on the phone or in person, and why asking individuals really matters. Thank you so much for this time, and I look forward to hearing what Gordon and Jessica have to say, and thanks again to Laura for including me in this call. I really think your work is so important. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you, Margie. This is Jessica Wernley. I'm sorry. Okay, just making sure no one was trying to chime in there. Jessica Wernley, formerly with United Congregations of Metro East, and now I do some different community organizing in the St. Louis region. So I wanted to talk about, Margie talked a lot about how to create a successful campaign and what all the moving pieces that look like, and I wanted to talk about how do you create a team in order to make that happen, in order to implement that plan. At UCM, we had an annual fundraiser, our ad book, where we solicited ads from different companies as well as individuals within the community that raised about $30,000 a year. And that had different teams in order to make that successful. So I just wanted to share a few lessons learned in terms of creating a team in general and in particular for a fundraising team. So one of the biggest lessons is to start with self-interest. So Margie talked a little bit about how to make an ask to a donor and making sure that you're tying that into what's important to them. And that's very important when you're looking at your teammates as well. I've heard of a lot of people who've been frustrated because they put out a call for a meeting or something really exciting that's going on and people didn't show up. Or people showed up and no one was really participating and no one seemed interested. And that's partly because they didn't understand what the interest of the people were before they invited them. So it's not just important to understand that about people you're asking for funding for, but also the people who are on your team. We had a phone-a-thon where we called donors to tell them about the good work of our organization, and we encouraged our callers to actually share what their personal connection to the work was. So it's always good to have your teammates be very clear about what their personal connection to the work is and to the organization. And then remind them of that often. You know, open up your meetings talking about what you know is on the hearts and the minds of the people who are in the room, to keep them very engaged and committed to the success of what you're trying to build. Another lesson learned is consistency. So sometimes, especially with smaller teams, like if you have a subcommittee or just a group that's working on something smaller and there's maybe three or four people, it's really easy to start being inconsistent, you know, start texting each other, oh, when should we meet next, or, you know, planning meetings a week out and not really giving people a lot of time. And that may work when you have two or three people on a team, but if you're trying to build your team to more people, it's really important to be consistent and let people know we're going to be here every week on Tuesday, you know, at this time, so they know when and where to show up. And once you start meeting regularly and people become comfortable with each other, then it's really easy to kind of get loose with the agenda and what happens during that meeting time. But again, it's really important to stay consistent and stay on track so that you can be respectful of other people's time. You don't want it to start feeling too clubby, and then when other people come in, they don't feel comfortable, they don't feel like they have the relationship to keep working on the team. So consistency is a very big thing. Seems obvious, but it's easy to get off track when people start, you know, getting comfortable with each other after they've met for so long. Another lesson learned is give everyone a role. So Margie outlined a lot of important aspects of running a successful fundraising campaign. There's a lot of moving parts, and there's a lot of ways that people can help. One mistake that I had made early on in my organizing work was trying to get everyone to do everything. You know, everyone has to make the fundraising asks. Everyone needs to follow up. But there are lots of different things and different ways that people can connect that will build off of their strengths. So, for example, some people might be better at making those big asks of donors, and they might have those relationships, while others are better at asking their friends and family for those smaller asks. And then other people are better at thank yous and follow-ups. You know, some people just love writing those thank you cards that sometimes it's difficult to find time for, but really make a big difference when you're asking for donations. That follow-up is really major. So think about what will make your campaign successful, what are the roles that need to be filled, and who can fill those roles, what are their strengths. Another thing to keep in mind is clear goals and timelines. So Margie talked about having that timeline where you make those asks, and that's not just important for the campaign itself, but that's really important for the people on your team. They need to know, they need to be able to see the end and know when it's going to be done so that they can keep motivated and keep going. So it's really important to make that timeline and stick to it and have those clear goals so that everyone can feel like they're moving forward and they know when it's going to be over and when they can celebrate. And the last point that I wanted to make today had to do with keeping the meetings exciting and action-oriented. So you don't want these meetings just to be about reporting out goals, because that's something that could easily be done in an email. You want to make it worth their time, and you want to make sure that you're being action-oriented. So setting goals and then planning strategies for how you're going to meet those. Giving out roles and responsibilities. That will make better use of your time, and it will allow people to want to show up to meetings. They'll know that they might miss something important if they don't show up. So those are just a quick points on lessons learned. A lot of them can be really simple, but are things that are easily forgotten when you're in the midst of everything and you've got a lot going on. It's hard to just sit down and make sure that you've got all these points lined up. So those are just a few quick points, and I look forward to hearing for some questions later.
Great. Thanks, Jessica. Hi. And thanks, Laura, for having me on the call. This is Gordon Mayer. I'm going to talk a little bit about lists and managing some of those systems to kind of get into the nitty-gritty of this. This will date me, but hopefully some people on the call are old enough to know what I'm talking about. One of my jobs in college, I worked at Reader's Digest, a magazine company that's famous for its sweepstakes. And every day I opened hundreds of letters with checks and order forms for the magazine in there, which I realized on reflection getting ready for this, that may have helped make me the fundraiser that I am today. So most of us are not working on the same scale as that. But what works in my experience, regardless of how big or small a list is having a few simple but solid systems in place. You should have a list. It should be separate. It should be a list of the folks that you're reaching out to. You should tell people what you're up to and what you need. You should be consistent and be just as polite online or over the mail as you would be in person. The most important thing is to make sure that you're keeping track of everyone who comes to your events. This sounds simple, but maybe is not when you actually think about it. Are you using sign-in sheets? A lot of times people forget until after a meeting is started, or then they think it's too late, or, you know, they don't get collected. One of the things that I think is, you know, the biggest challenge or the most frustrating, and I know this is a real challenge because it does take time to get stuff done, it's always frustrating to see when you walk into a group's office and see a pile of dog-eared loose-leaf sheets covered with names and numbers, and someone says, gosh, we really need to type up those sign-in sheets. There's money in that pile there for you if we're talking about fundraising or advocacy, really. So it is all about getting those names recorded in a centralized space. The bigger you get, the more work this is. It should be some kind of database, but let's just assume that we're starting very small. I think if you're talking about fewer than 50 people, well, okay, you can keep that, on a clipboard. You can keep that in one or two people's kind of minds. If you're getting up to, between 50 and 250 people, you can keep that in a spreadsheet like Microsoft Excel or a Google spreadsheet or OpenOffice that people can look at together. But once you get beyond about 200, 250 people pretty quickly, I think you'll find that it's easier and better to use some of the resources that are shared in the guide that we emailed earlier or some other tool. What we're seeing is increasingly there's more and more different ways to do this. So what I've given you at the bottom is a couple of the most obvious and commonly used tools and also some guides to other places where you can read about things. Because every organization people tend to have things they like better when they're choosing something, some kind of database tool. So there are a lot of different ways to pick one that will work best for you. I think, again, this is pretty straightforward, but I think it's worth saying that what you should be collecting, think about this as the columns, name, first name, last name, cell phone, home phone, email, organization or group. A lot of databases aren't really set up to think like this, but I think most of us do think like this. Many of the people that we work with, because they're community leaders, they're leaders of an organization, leaders of a block club, and that's the kind of information that you might want. You probably want to have some kind of notes. The longer you do this, the more you work with people, the more information you're going to have, and the more you're going to want to keep track of that. And I think that it's useful to have address, city, state, and zip. What we do find a lot of times is that many people do all of this work online. They use email. They use social media. People often, many databases, NationBuilder is a good example of this. They provide spaces for physical addresses, but there's not a lot of expectation that you're going to do that. And that depends on your organization and your style a little bit. So I guess there are two purposes to keeping a list like this. The first one, of course, obviously, is you're keeping track of the people that you're going to be communicating out to. Obviously, we're talking about fundraising today, so you're perhaps asking them for money. But the second is to get the information out of one person's mind and make it available for others to use, too. Margie and Jessica both talked about teams. They both stress that this kind of work, it's kind of too big for one person to do, especially as you as you get more ambitious and your organization's needs grow as well. So part of the idea of using a tool is to have other people be able to share the information, so it's not just, you know, one person holding all of the relationships. It's really a good example of how you can have many hands making light work with a list that makes it possible to share all of the work, since all of the information is right there where everyone can use it. You may find that one of the things that also means is you need to have some common agreements about how you're going to share information. And I think sometimes we get a little, you can get a little bit process oriented. So, you know, you just have to work through that and recognize you may spend a little bit of time thinking about some details that are a little on the persnickety side when you're coming up with a list and setting rules for how everybody's going to do things. But hopefully you do that one time and you don't have to revisit those questions. The other thing that we've seen that as like sort of the biggest mistake people make with having a list is to not segment it. And by that, what I mean is that they tend to, you know, a lot of times we'll work with an organization and they'll have a list. Maybe they have 500 people, maybe they have 1,000 people, and they just send everything to everybody on the list. And segmenting it is the idea of taking the list and splitting it up. You can split it up by geography. You can split it up by people who've given once before, people who've given, you know, more than a certain amount. If you've heard the expression micro-targeting, the idea that, you know, you can get really to really fine-tune distinctions between groups of people, this is kind of like that. I think Susie Quinn from Torch Can Do maybe is one of the folks who's on the phone today. I was reading about her story and reading on the COTJ website right before this, that folks in Torch, Ohio, where she's working around fracking, they might have different concerns depending on where they live. For some people who are right next to where there's a waste dump, it might be odor. Other people might be concerned about the trucking routes that are going through town. So it would be an example. You might, I mean, it might be the same message for both of those groups, but we could imagine different meetings or different agendas for both of those folks or different messages. You could go on about this for a long time. And again, the bigger your list, the more kind of fine-tuned distinctions you're likely to want to make. Other than that, I think that's very important to say that, you know, we need to follow a certain set of rules. The resource guide has a link to the federal CAN-SPAM law, which basically sets out what are the rules for communicating with lots of people online at one time. For example, one of the rules is if you're sending bulk email, which is defined more by the content of what's in it than by the number of emails you're sending, there has to be a link for receivers to use to opt out of getting email from you in the future. That's why we really shouldn't just message 100 people from our own email accounts, you know, even if we just mean we're just doing good. So there are a couple of resources on the list here. Canva for making flyers, Idealware for just checking and looking for tools that are going to work for you, IssueLab for research on energy and the environment, MailChimp, which is just, you know, the simplest and free if you have 2,000 or fewer subscribers and send up to 12,000 emails per month, Nonprofit Tech for Good, which is a great place to get ideas and information on how to use lists and really all kinds of technology in your advocacy, and TechSoup, which has software, free software, and information on running a nonprofit. So I will stop there and hear what kind of questions folks may have. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks to our great panel. That was that's really information-packed. So this is Laura again, and I'd like to ask folks to go ahead if you have a question. You can take yourself off mute by doing *6, and feel free to ask a question to the entire panel or to one person. So we're open for questions.
Hi, it's Pat Clark from Clemson, Lackawanna. If no one else is going, I'll go first.
Good, Pat. Go right ahead.
Hi, Pat. Sure. So, hi, everyone. This is probably a couple of questions that span all of the panelists, so thank you very much. We're going through this right now over in northeastern Pennsylvania. We've got, we're a member of CHEJ, and they've been a wonderful asset for us. Fundraising is something we're tackling, you know, all hands on deck right now. So one of the things we've been doing is going through and looking at different forms of software. So thank you for going through the kind of the tools and ideas there. Gordon, I think you covered most of it. I guess my first question would be, in the event of putting software in place to help manage everything, is it worth paying for some of the paid programs, the CRM/DonorSpace software? You mentioned NationBuilder. That's one. There's a couple others out there. Are there any that you've seen work better than the free ones? Is it worth investing in, assuming you've got some people that are technical that can help build it out?
That's a great question. Well, so how big is your list, Pat, around about?
Yeah, we've got to centralize it. That's part of the issue why we need to do it.
Right.
We do regular update informational emails, so I don't have that in front of me, though, but it's a decent size list.
Yeah. You know, so I think there's two great points. One is, and Jessica and Margie, I'd love to hear what you guys think about this, too. I think asking for money is quite often a break point where the companies that are out there feel like, well, you know, if somebody is asking for money, they should be paying us money in order to do it, right? So depending on, like, if you're going to move past, like, the basic, we're going to have a PayPal page and ask people to donate there, that's a, you know, pretty rudimentary. But if you want to start to raise a little bit more money online, then I do think it makes sense to look at a paid site. And Laura will tell you, I'm a little bit biased. I feel like, you know, you get what you pay for, kind of. And I guess one final thought about that before we hear from other folks is the thing that's a little challenging is there's so many choices now. There's just a lot of tools out there. So let me stop there. Maybe people have sort of pet databases that they like. It does sort of, a little bit is about personal style.
So this is Margie. I wanted to say a couple of things. One is, it depends on your organization, how tech savvy you are, and how many people are going to be touching this CRM that you choose, the customer relations material that you choose. A lot of people like Salesforce. Some people started with Salsa, but it's not specifically about fundraising, so they had a harder time with it, and other people liked it. So it's like saying, which clothing do you like? What color do you like? You want to know. You want to find out more about your organization and what matches you. A lot of the groups like Salesforce will take you through a tutorial and not necessarily sell you, quote unquote. They'll just show you what will happen with this. Another one that I like a lot that is free and I think is very worthwhile is PVCRM, which is put up by Progressive Technology Project, PTP, a really thoughtful and good organization that helps not-for-profits in how they manage their list. But know who's going to be doing this, who's going to be touching this. How many bells and whistles do you really need? And how can you use this to your social justice advantage? Not like, oh, God, we got this thing and nobody knows how to do anything with it.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I don't know if anyone else chimed in. I'll keep asking questions, though, if I've got the line.
Usually takes people a couple minutes. The people like things, information is percolating. Go ahead.
All right, I'll ask another one, and this, again, would be something that's probably applicable to everyone. You know, we're a regional group defined as Northeastern Pennsylvania, and one of the things we've, you know, there's those stats awesome, and Marjorie, thank you for starting with all those, you know, in terms of how much money is given. Have you all seen if you had to batch things into groups between, you know, local versus regional versus national campaigns in terms of what buckets of fundraising are reasonable, and I guess it's all dependent upon your cause, but is there a natural kind of plateau for organizations that are limited by either a locality or a region?
Somebody else, I have things to say, Mrs. Marge, but I don't want to hog this. So do you have things you want to say, Gordon or Jessica?
I'm waiting to hear what your. I think I know what your answer is going to be, but.
Well, if you go on Giving USA, which is where all the statistics come from in the past year, they often break it down by type of giving. So, is it for social good? Is it for the environment? And it's an expensive report. You don't have to buy the report. There are other groups, and if you just Google it, that will give you a summary that you can look at. And then you have to try to figure out, well, where do we fit in this? So an example would be public society benefit was $26.95 billion for 2015, an estimate. Human services was $45.21 billion. So how you're approaching the work that you do in the environment, you might fit into one of those different places for what's there. So they don't break it down by repeat donors, except there is a statistic that somebody who comes to your event, if they're coming because you honored somebody, a lot of those people are not going to stay around to keep supporting your organization. You have to work really hard to get them. And I don't even think 100% is a good benchmark for evaluating. I think if you kept 20% of those people that came to your event when you were honoring somebody came in because of who you honored, that would be tremendous. So to try to think about how you break that stuff down. And then a lot of people give a first time, and then a lot of groups the donor never comes back for a second gift. So your big goal is not just to get the first gift, but to get the second, third, and fourth we use the word stewardship, keeping that person engaged, keeping them involved so they think, oh, yes, of all the places I could be giving money, this place is speaking to my values, my love of the community, my care of this constituency, or my passion about this issue. People come in different ways that way. So that's the thing, is to work towards getting the repeat donor. And the drop-off is tremendous, so this really matters.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Gordon, comments, Jessica?
No, I think that's good.
Does anybody have a question? Because I have one.
Go for it.
All right, this is Gary Bent. I'm with a group called Eastern Connecticut Green Action. So basically, we have about 100 members, but we are not a 501c4. And since we do political action, we'd have to be one. Is that going to be a big impediment to our fundraising? We do have an organization that will be our fiduciary agent.
Do you have a bank account?
Not yet.
Do you want to run that through your fiduciary?
Yes, we'd run that through our fiduciary.
Got it. Jessica, Margie, what do you have experience with?
It's like a fiscal sponsor. For people who don't know what fiduciary is, it could be a fiscal sponsor or a fiscal agent. Somebody's going to accept the money on your behalf. Some organizations make a 501c3, which is the IRS-designated way that your donors can get a tax deduction. And this matters a lot for people who itemize. That is, they give enough money away. It's less the people who put in $5 into the church basket when it gets passed around, and more the person who gives $100 to their alma mater or to their kid's school or some bigger donation like that to you, then they're going to want to get a tax deduction for it. So some organizations have a 501c3 or a sponsor that has a C3 and then a separate arm that's a C4. The C4 is telling the government, yes, we are going to say vote for so-and-so, don't vote for so-and-so. As a C3, you're not allowed to do that. So some of your people that you're raising money from, they won't care whether they're getting a tax deduction because they're so passionate about this, and because you've explained to them that the ability to do political work, capital P, on who to vote for matters so much to your issue. Other people are going to not have such an incentive. They want to get the tax deduction, especially, and they will want to know there's a place to give to. So you might need to split them out. If you're just getting started, I think you should look at your membership and look at the people you're likely to be in touch with and ask for money and think for yourself, are these the people that will care desperately that they are going to get a tax deduction or not? And is our work mostly about educating the community and doing organizing so a C3 designation is just fine? Or in fact, no, we're going to mostly be doing big political, big lobbying work. And so we want that C4 designation. So I would think about the population, think about your work, and then choose the one that you want.
Okay, I don't think we'd qualify for a C3 because we're working on the local level to get...
You get it as a local. You can get it as a local group. You can also just not get it and have the fiscal sponsor have it be a C3. But that means you've got to do work that's not going to get your sponsor in trouble. I mean, you can't... And you can go to the Alliance for Justice if you're not sure, well, which could we do and why would we do it? And they'll explain to you what these different designations are. But
yeah,
being little or small has nothing to do with it. You could still do it.
Well, we're pushing for political action on the local level and then on the state level.
So if your political action that is the C4 and you need to know who you're reaching out to and make it clear to them when you're asking for money that this will not be something that they can get a tax deduction for and see if this works out. For a lot of groups, they have an education fund. They have some other name for it, NAACP, for example. You might see there's that, and then there's the NAACP Education Fund, and that's the C3 arm. So we could talk more about it offline as well. I think we heard another voice.
Yes.
Susie Quinn, I had
it. Margie, I did want to just make a clarifying point about the C3, C4 piece. So this is Laura. We actually had a call on this a little while ago where we really got in depth about C3, C4, and all about political action. So you guys should check out the CACJ website and look at the civic engagement training call that we did earlier, and you could probably get some more information from that. You can, when people say political action, sometimes that means like taking one trip to the state capitol per year, taking a busload of volunteers. As long as you're using a lot of volunteers in the work that you're doing with lobbying, that lobbying does not count. It only counts when you've got the staff people. And then there's a certain percentage of your budget that you,
right,
you can still use to do that kind of work. And so thinking through what are we using staff for? What are we using volunteers for? You know, if we get a C3, we're going to have to keep it up, and we're going to have to, you know, do all of the paperwork that's involved in that. Are we going to be around for, you know, the next 10 years so that we'll be able to, you know, have staff people that will actually do that? Thinking through all of those questions are important because you don't want to set something elaborate up that then, you know, doesn't get used or takes your precious time that you're using on advocacy away from the advocacy. And the advocacy work that's in your heart ends up, you know, with you filling out a lot of forms. So I think if you want to think all of that through, I'm happy to talk with you more about that. And my email is laurabarrett314@gmail. Happy to talk all of this over and think through sort of what kind of organization you really want to set up.
And think about it in terms of who you're going to raise. This is a fundraising call, not just a C3C4 call. So think about who we're asking money from, and then take Laura's good wisdom and make a good match for what you're going to choose to be.
Can I ask Gordon a question? He mentioned a free software, and then it was all a bunch of letters. I didn't get it written down.
Right.
Was it the Civi CRM? Is that the one that you were thinking of?
Possibly, yeah. Could you say it slowly?
Yeah, sure. So there's some Civi CRM, C-I-V, as in Victor, I, and then CRM, which stands for Constituent Relations Management. And, you know, I mean, we say that in the database world, which, you know, like I speak database, but I'm not sure that I totally count as a full-on nerd. They have a very funny saying, which is, it's free as in kittens, meaning, like, it's free to adopt a kitten. But then, you know, you have to learn the care and feeding of it. And so what you find is, that's why sometimes I do feel like you kind of, I'd almost rather pay $50 a month or maybe $100 a month. And I know that, you know, starts to talk or sound like real money. But to tell you the truth, what I really like, I like things that look like my computer, like my Windows interface. They're easy to use. They look pretty. It's really clear how to, like, make a message. And some, like, Civi CRM's a good example, and Salt is another one. They're kind of similar, where, you know, there's a certain amount of finagling, and they're very powerful. You can make them do, like, a million things. Salsa is a great example. It was created for labor unions, and you can reach, like, you know, a million people or something crazy like that. But it's going to ask a little bit more of you in terms of upfront figuring out how to use it. So does that help? That's probably more than you asked for, Susie.
Well, no, this is, at least I have a hint. Hints are good.
Okay, all right.
Thank you.
Well, and if people really want to geek out, we could schedule a geek out. I mean, I don't know, Laura, if you want to schedule a geek out call. I know you're going to have Hannah come and talk about online organizing at some point.
Yeah, we are going to do a social media call later, but I think, this is a really important question. So, I mean, if folks are wanting more info, of, you know, and wanting to talk with us more about this, we're happy to do it offline because it is pretty detail-oriented. So what other, we have time probably for one or two more questions.
Yeah, Gretchen Brewer here in Port Townsend. Am I on?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm with Port Townsend Air Watchers in Washington State. We get asked a lot, a lot of what we need is just to cover basic overhead. And, we're a pretty small organization. And there's some resistance. We get some resistance from people. They want it to go to an action of, you know, this or that. But a lot of what we're providing is just research that takes a lot of time. And, and setting up meetings and things like that. So how can we best present that to people as something that they should donate to?
You know, the overhead is part of your story. It's part of the work that you're doing. So if you're talking about, if you tell a story about a campaign that you're doing or a family that's asthma rate went up because of something going on in the community and the plan you did and the staff that made it happen and the materials that you wrote, the research you did, people will understand it better than just saying overhead. So I would find the language to describe it through the lens of the end of the day, how is our community better because of your organization through that lens. I think people understand it a lot better than I think they hear more about, well, the Red Cross built exactly four houses in Haiti, and they spend all the money on overhead, so it becomes this evil thing. We need to debunk that and talk about what it means to make that action happen, to make that work possible, and tell it through the story.
Hi, this is Susie Quinn from Torch, Ohio, and thank you for your time. The reason I tuned in today is because asking for money is a very difficult thing for me personally, and our community is not an affluent community. And I was interested in how, I know there's some people in our group I think would be really good at this, but what are some other ways that we can influence people to, you know, talk to other people and ask for money?
So this is Jeff Calstar. One of the communities that I worked in was East St. Louis, and there were not a lot of affluent people at all. That's one of the most impoverished communities in the country. And I will say that a lot of times those are the people who are even more willing to give. And whether it's $5, $10, don't overlook them as potential givers. I mean, a lot of them signed up to be sustainers for $5 a month. They really want to do their part, and so making that accessible and saying no donation really is too small helps with that. But there are, aside from money, there are a lot of other ways that people can give to an organization, including their time and talent. So I would just say don't overlook them as potential donors.
I would say also to back up what Jessica said, we often think that poor people, we take away their agency to put their dollars into the collective good, and we shouldn't do that. People want to give. Look at how they give to church on a regular basis, and the church doesn't say, oh, no, you're poor, you don't have to give. And they promise salvation at church. We are promising a kind of salvation through this collective effort. A couple of the things that people might be able to do is to do something called a house party. It could be a barbecue in their backyard. It could be coming over for coffee, for brunch. It could be at a bar, as somebody does, where the host's job is to gather the people together. Somebody else can make the pitch. Somebody else can ask for the money there. If you want to help people imagine, what's this money going to? What picture can we form in our head that we're going to want to give to during this event? You can also do it just to collect names to follow up later on with people. But I want to say something. I found some of the best people at asking for money swore to me up and down that they could never do this. And in our trainings in person, they practiced both on the phone and face-to-face, and you know what? They were great at it. And once they got a couple of wins, a couple of yeses under their belt, they were like, yeah, let me at it. This is great. I'm explaining to people, having a conversation about this work, and at the end of this conversation, they're psyched up, and they give us a donation. Wow. So I wouldn't count people out for this. I agree with Jessica, time and talent really matters, but it's also, I don't want you to use it as an excuse to move away from the people's ability to give you money, which will make the engine of your work move forward.
Thank you very much. A free face painting for the kids in the community.
Nice.
August, yes, face painting. And people were wanting to give us money because I guess they were just used to, you know, paying a dollar to have their child's face painted. So we were just kind of surprised by that.
$300 billion given away in the United States. Do we think all those people were miserable in giving you that money? No. So I could see why people wanted to give to you.
I always like the example and the story of the church, you know, and when we do fundraising workshops, we talk about, you know, the fact that the people who are the best fundraisers are the people who ask, you know, you've done this, that kind of workshop with a lot of folks who are, you know, go to church on a Sunday. They're like, oh, yeah, I guess they do. They ask every Sunday. It's very personal. Nobody is, there's no exception. So,
they don't say, oh, you gave last Sunday, don't give this Sunday. No, they ask you again. Right?
It's true. They don't expect a lot, but they do expect it.
Right.
I think the other important thing to remember is that people are giving to a variety of organizations, you know, five or six things that they're supporting regularly. So sometimes there are people who are like, oh, I know they're already giving to this organization. Well, that means they're a generous person. They'd be happy to give to you, too. So,
right.
You know, we try to talk ourselves out of asking for money, and, you know, I'm just as guilty as anybody else. But it's one of those things when you think about it and you think about what's the asset going to work for my brother, for my best friend, and then you start rehearsing in your head, seeing how that's going to look, and you sort of can get more comfortable with it. And then actually rehearsing it with another person can be helpful, too.
That's right.
So I think we probably need to think about closing the call down. I have a couple of closing remarks. It's been a great exchange. I really appreciate everybody who asked the questions. I had Pat, Gary, Gretchen, and Susie. I think there was one more person. Thank you for bringing your concerns forward. And remember, we're here in between calls as well. Our next call is scheduled for the third Tuesday, just the way that this one was, and that will be on the 18th of October. So it will be the same bat time, same bat channel, so 12 o'clock Eastern. And we, feel free to, let us know what topic you're interested in. You can put that on that online survey that we're going to be sending out to you after this call. We really do appreciate you filling out the online survey. It really helps us a great deal. And don't forget, we also are recording the call, so if you'd like to share this with somebody else, or check out the other calls that we've had this year, the training calls, that would be great. And I would be remiss if I did not say at the end of this fundraising call, we would love to have you as a group member of CHEJ for $100 a year. So thanks very much, friends of Lackawanna. Others have been wonderful supporters of ours, and we appreciate it very, very much. So
Yeah. Thanks
to everybody for all your terrific work. And Margie, did you want to say one more thing?
Yeah, I just want to say one thing. There's a great, I'm going to send a list to Laura, send out to you to help you spark your thinking about individuals that you could give to, that you could ask for money for. And secondly, the Grassroots Institute for Fundraising Training has a great journal, and you can get access to back issues once you sign up for it. It's a very, very, very good resource.
I will say that's the best $30 in fundraising I've ever spent.
Yep. It's great.
All right. Great. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Laura.
Bye. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.